Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 4, Episode 7, titled Layaway. I don't know about you, but I feel like this whole episode is just layaway for the future war that's about to come. We've put it down an installment. The first installment was Dr. Sitter. The second installment is going to be Kalamita. Out of the satchel was a fake second installment that we just also put that on a credit card. I don't know. It's it felt to me like it was getting us to the place we need to go. And I enjoyed watching it. You know, it's like, yeah. I'm invested in the story that they're telling. And so when a couple of episodes like the last one and this one come along and they're just kind of like moving things into place, I'm totally cool with that. I'm just watching it and kind of thinking like, okay, you know, where could all this be going? But also just enjoying my time with these characters.
Yeah, it reminds me, like, if this episode was a stretch of The Godfather, this would be where Michael is picked up by, I can't remember, the police chief and his mafia goon, and they're driving him over to New Jersey, and then they do the U-turn on the turnpike, and ooh, isn't that excited, and they pull up to the diner. Uh-huh. Like, you have to get from that point to this for the rest of the movie to happen, but like, and you got to make it interesting, you know, you got to have, oh my gosh, where are they taking me? Are we going to Jersey? Oh, that's not what the plan was. Are we going to do a U-turn on the top and lose the tail? Like, yeah, I don't begrudge them for trying to spice up these, what are clearly very connective, the tissue type of episodes. And there's a lot of strong performances and some good character work. This movie, since there's not a lot happening, like actually happening, it allows the episode to kind of really take its time on some of these other things.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Rock processing his, speaking of laying away grief, I guess, like, you know, he's grieving for something that hasn't actually happened, which I thought was interesting to watch someone do metaphysically, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the better parts. I think this episode is the first time I've seen Jason Schwartzman in this show and understood why he was picked for this role. I think like that scene where he's explaining, you know, Satchel's death and stuff, he kind of hits that perfect tone between honesty and lie and like casual and serious, and I wasn't feeling him in previous episodes. This is the
Snake
first one.
And weasel.
Absolutely.
He really finds that
competent and moron, like, you know,
because I do feel at the end of this episode I do feel like those two, Schwartzman and I forget the guy playing Gaetano's name, they are just not, I don't think they're doing what the show thinks they're doing for me. And I worry that that's going to be a problem because I feel like they're telling the story of Gaetano as a caged beast being released.
Huh.
But they had really talked me into the theory that he was all talk and he's just kind of like a bully that's made out of paper and he's going to wilt in any kind of adversity. So it's like, I don't know. I don't know if the show wanted me to think that, but in the performance and the direction they absolutely did. So I don't know. But that's the thing, is like, you know, Noah Hawley has definitely had some twists and turns up his sleeves in previous Fargos and other shows I've seen him do, like Legion. I've seen him paint himself in the corner I didn't think he'd get himself out of. So we'll see. He clearly, with the kind of cliffhanger at the end of this episode, he clearly thinks what he's doing is clever as fuck.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because we're the audience kind of like on Chris Rock's henchman, Opal side, like, gee whiz, boss, I hope you're doing right. Because it seems like you're just almost throwing your hands up in the air, not giving a fuck about what happens. Too fatalistic.
You know, I mean, obviously Loy is smart and we'll probably talk about this more, but it feels like a tennis match where, you know, he doesn't have like a great return shot here, but at least he got it back over the net. It's like, and now it's your problem to deal with, right? Because we know that New York is a bit of a problem for Giusto, because Gaetano is a problem, and he tried to use Loy to wipe that problem off the board. Turns out Loy's too smart for that. And he just sent the problem back, right?
But also maybe there was a third way that he could have that would have been better than just kind of like the double reverse. I'm really looking forward to seeing, because it seems like it's not just that, there's something else that's going on that's going to make him seem clever in retrospect, but it's not going to involve Swanee and Zelmer, unless how tricksy going to be, like, did he say that in front of Wef just so he knows Wef would go back and it would get to them? Like, there could be some fourth dimensional chess being played by Cannon's crew.
I was a little bit nonplussed by some of the other connective stuff. Like, I'm still looking for where Mayflower connects to all this. I think I see the connection there now. Okay.
I think I see that.
I have some ideas to where that might go, but we can talk about that in a minute. And also Ethelreda stuff. I don't even know what purpose it's really serving at this point. It's just kind of keeping that story alive so you don't forget about it.
And connecting her to Lemuel, I think, is going to be, there's going to be a little Romeo Juliet kind of action going on here.
Yeah, clearly she, you know, thought he was cute or whatever and was nervous about it.
It's another tie to outlaw culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, her being her own person versus fitting into one of those slots.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Okay, Jim, with our initial thoughts out of the way, perhaps we get down to business. And I thought we could serve some of this, the short-term business up front. For example, Nurse Mayflower.
Okay.
She bakes up some macaroons for Dr. Harvard.
Does she?
I want to talk about that in a minute, I was really hot for this theory that you're going to find out that Dr. Harvard actually is not a doctor, and, you know, he's essentially like a Dr. Senator situation. Where his mom gave him a prestigious last name. I don't think it's going to happen because the man died this episode. She poisoned him with a quote unquote macaroon.
Right.
Are they suggesting that this self-adhesive gauze adhesed into his windpipe and also comprised, like, what was the poison that went into this macaroon?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't even notice that there was like a specific thing going in other than it's Orietta cooking. It's
self-adhesive gauze. Ugh. And I'm like, surely they're not indicating that this can be simultaneously the most delicious macaroon this guy's ever had in his life and also have enough self-adhesive gauze to strangle him in his windpipe.
Yeah.
I kind of rather they not showed anything than self-adhesive gauze. Like, because I would buy that she's got a closet full of nightmares that she could put in there that can stop a man's windpipe within 30 seconds of eating it. Self-adhesive gauze, I don't know.
Experience I had with it. I didn't even notice the self-adhesive gauze. Even though I watched this twice.
If you had, it'd taken you right out of the scene, wouldn't it, Jim?
It would have, yeah. But as I watched it, it was totally fine. I was in that camp where I just thought, oh, she's got some kind of poison in this thing. Cool.
I do wonder what the hell it's supposed to be, because like I feel like anything that would act that fast, like, I don't know, what the hell, cyanide? You'd also just be like puking up green foam or some shit like that.
Well, but see, the thing is, like, what is it? Is it cyanide or strychnine or something that tastes like almonds? Like, isn't that the perfect fucking thing to put into a macaron?
You're right. You're right. Ooh, what's this exotic treat you're talking about? Yeah. We're talking about macaroons, yeah. Jim.
You're right. Sorry, I mispronounced it apparently.
Okay, I want to get to that. I want to get to the macaroon controversy, but I also, all the silly stuff aside about how she killed him. I thought the performance was like just very chilling. The way she, you know, as soon as he succumbs, she starts going through and immediately goes to what she's there for, which is to get her hands on this letter. Mm-hmm. She then like goes up to him and like squats down, and there's like this look on his face where he realizes that she's wiping the crumbs off his face to kind of hide her crime and just how like businesslike she is about it. And then performative and like trying out a few faces and screams before she actually settles on one that's not really convincing.
Yeah.
She's a Dexter type sociopath. She doesn't, I don't think she understands that other people in the world are real and have feelings and affections. She's just approximating to get maximum advantage, and she thinks everyone else is too. It's wild. It was wild. It's very chilling. And I love the Noah Hawley straight from Legion psychedelic, Dr. Harvard's dying and seeing her as this kind of, I don't know, like very dark pastel angel of death with the wings and whatnot. That was a very cool, very cool visual. He doesn't usually get to paint with that kind of palette on Fargo.
Yeah, for sure. And she gets kind of what she wants out of the letter, but kind of not, right? She sees the exact text of it, but it's signed a concerned citizen, which I thought Ethelreda had used a fake name. I guess she didn't use any name. So, you know, obviously we've speculated that she's going to find Ethelreda's journal in her closet of horrors. And she's going to compare the handwriting because she now has that letter, right? So,
well, I almost feel like there's an implication that Mayflower hasn't been in her closet since Ethelreda left the thing there. And that I kind of makes sense that like she hasn't killed anyone new
or hasn't noticed it. She did kill her patient last episode.
Oh, you're right.
And now she's cooked up a batch of self-adhesive macaroons this doctor. So she must have gone in the closet. Maybe she just didn't notice it.
How do you not notice something that's not supposed to be there, especially in your like little murder shrine? Like, I figure that there's like that stuff is all like laid out with intention, right?
Yeah. Oh,
you know, that didn't seem like some haphazard like dragon's hoard, right? This is a very Hannibal Lecter cataloged collection kind of thing. She seems that type of precise malevolence. I don't know. Let's get into the macaroon controversy. So macaroons are like a buttery coconut cookie. And what is the other thing?
And they're pretty like misshapen, right? They're generally like a roundish kind of cookie, but you know, because they have chunks and stuff in them, they're not these perfect
shredded coconuts,
pristine, like pedophore-esque type things.
No, they look like haystacks.
Right. What she cooks is a macaron, which is a French-Italian It's what she describes, right? She describes macarons, but she calls them macaroons. And it's my opinion that Dr. Harvard knows this. That Dr. Harvard doesn't want to eat these macarons because they're not macaroons, and he loves macaroons. And so when she brings him in and says, hey, I made these macaroons for you, he's like, ah, these aren't macaroons. And then she convinces him to try them, and he tries them like he's never had such a delicious dessert before, right? That second bite he takes, it just a glorious bit of acting. I mean, it's amazing. So in my opinion, like, he's trying a brand new dessert for the very first time, and his mind is blown by it. Because I don't think she makes, like you said, with the self-adhesive gauze in it, it can't be the best macaroon he's ever had, right?
I don't know. No, you're exactly right. But on the other hand, because I had this elaborate theory about him being kind of a fraud, or you know, not fraudulent in the same way that he's just trying to fit in like Americans do, right? He's trying to get ahead, by hook or by crook. That he kinda is the type of dude that, you know, might pronounce macaron macaroon. Because he is Midwestern, and, you know, he's like read about these things in magazines, but and maybe someone brought him back to him when they went to New York City once, or when he was, it's fit into his kind of like character. But you're right. If he was expecting a macaroon and got a macaron, and that also, because, yeah, it does explain his hesitance to eat it, you know. And I don't want to make her feel like she's an idiot and all, but the thing is like, he doesn't seem like the character that would hold back. Like, if he wanted a macaroon and she brought him a macaron, he'd be like, Miss Mayflower, I think you've made the fatal mistake of mistaking a macaroon for a macaron. And because he's never been afraid to like verbally pile drive her and be casually cruel to her that way before. So. But I don't know. Let's move on from the macaroons, because I'm sure people are like, Jesus Christ, it's just a cookie. I do want to say that, like, this does feel like the thing that's going to bring Mayflower back into Josto's orbit, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is the latest of kind of things that he hinted about, you know, having an agenda with, and, you know, she picked up on, and she's going to, you know, she had her own reasons to do it. But I think this is going to be the thing that brings her back into Josto's orbit.
Yeah, and didn't we see...
it's where their business intersects.
Deffy eyeing Josto as he was sitting outside the hospital looking at Harvard's window. Was it Deffy who was watching him?
I didn't think so, but Deffy was definitely watching them. They're definitely on the radar now, because he was overseeing when they were showing up to the club, right?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm pretty sure he's making the connection about how everything's connected here in Kansas City.
Yeah, I can't quite remember. I thought that he was watching them outside the hospital too. And if that's the case, then, you know, it could bring Deffy back into the equation.
Yeah, that was just so early on, and he wasn't on to, like, the Italians weren't connected to his official Marshall business at all.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He seems to not care too much about other business, right? Like, this episode, he lets Otis kind of do his own thing, even though he knows what's up. Like, I know you're working with these guys. Let me just give you some words of advice instead of hauling your ass in, because that's not his job, A. And B,
that's true.
Could you even do that? Like,
I do think he's kind of prone. Like, so I don't think he's exactly like Raylan Givens from Justified, who we said, like, you know, he just literally didn't care. Like, he comes into a bar and there's like a pile of machine guns and cocaine on the table. He's like, I don't give a fuck. I just want to know about my perp or whatever. I'm looking for my fugitive. This guy does seem like he's willing to mix it up, like him going and doing dueling mean mugs with Gaetano in front of the general store, right? Like, him saying, well, what the hell, you want to go mount up and raid this place? Like, I do feel like he is much more targets of opportunity for the Lord, kind of, you know. He's got a primary mission, and that's the most important thing. Everything revolves around that. But if he can bust a mafia organization and, you know, this upstart canon organization in the process of doing the other stuff, boy, that would make him feel real good.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that wraps up the Mayflower business. Let's move on to Ethel Rita business. Very brief, but momentous. You know, Loy's crew is taking over the funeral parlor. If you'd forgotten that he owns them, and they're using it from some kind of staging operation, moving, looks like, liquor in and out of there. And Ethel Rita kind of stink eyes Loy's oldest son, Lemuel. But also, it's like a stink eye kind of attraction, and it's kind of, I get the feeling it's a little mutual. But then, you know, Ethel Rita gets shy and she scampers off upstairs, and Lemuel is menaced by the ghost of Mr. Snowman from a coffin.
Yeah.
Really? I like coming out of nowhere. I was done with Halloween, but all of a sudden I forgot this is a spook show. Very well shot and very creepy. And honestly had me kind of a little gripped up when Lemuel kind of saunters up there to go knocking on that coffin.
Like, yeah.
You don't want to knock on the coffin when it's a rockin', because Mr. Snowman will eat your soul or some shit.
Well, what are they trying to do with
it? It's been through enough.
Are they?
I don't know.
Because I speculated that this was like, oh, the haunting of her blackness was like following her and her family through the years, and like, but they're all like, but that's not going to pass, right? That's not something that like Ethel Reed is going to pass to Lemuel, because he's black too. He knows as much as anybody.
Yeah, and it doesn't fit like the mental illness kind of thing or it's like a substance abuse thing, unless maybe it is because they talked about Lemuel hanging around these gin joints where they're slinging heroin and whatnot. If this is, you know, because Mayer kind of gives a little bit of a fried vibe to herself. It's like she's probably you know, gone across the street as far as mind altering substances. I wonder, and they very much drink a lot.
Oh yeah.
I wonder if they're suggesting that's the only thing I can think that could be. And or if it's just a family curse, like if it's literally just contact with someone and it's a 7 days, the ring type situation, because that's the only way he's possibly stalking Lemuel.
Yeah. I don't know. And I don't know if Ethel Rita is like scampering off here because she knows that she's cursed and doesn't want to like affect this cute boy that she sees, or if she's just, you know, shy because he's cute and she doesn't know how to handle it. And like,
I think it's a little bit because the former, I just don't think she thinks she's cursed. Like, I still think like,
even with all that talk from Swanee and stuff,
I really don't. I mean, cause she came back from that and wrote the letter to try to bring down Mayflower. So I think she still feels as her, she still sees herself as the heroine in her story.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I love it. I love that there is this like just fucking out and out ghost story in the middle of this gangster deal. I do love it. I think it's cool.
Uh-huh.
Just when I forget about it, he comes right back. So yeah, I don't know. It's again for supposedly what I thought was the main character of this season, she has been really put in the back shelf of the refrigerator these last two episodes.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see if her business picks up in future weeks. The Fada business. So we kind of start off the episode with Josto finding the body of the guy that got shot. I've already forgotten his name. The Camp Elegance person.
Yep, he's got a name. He definitely has a name.
He's got a name, but it's erased. It's erased now. The last like people that remembered his name and forgot him, he finally experienced that second death you always hear people talking about.
Domini?
Yeah, there you go. Old Domini.
Yeah, Domini.
He's looking over this guy, and Calamita's in his ear just be like, told you, boss, that the Irish was the traitor, and he choked up your sister, and he shot your other dude, and Josto's over it, and he sends Calamita on this mission to go to Loy's house, kill the Irish, kill the boy, you gotta find him, which is all well and good, but then I thought he made a pretty big leadership faux pas at the end. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
And they say, what should we do with this guy's body? And he says, leave him for the birds. And I felt like some of the guys are with kind of like looked at each other like, that's some cold shit. You know, there's a certain fraternity that you're a La Familia, for example, that you're really leaning on. And it's like one thing if there's no, you know, the cops are on the way and there's nothing that can be done, but just leaving this guy to have his eyes picked out by crows. Holy shit, that's cold.
And it's also a little sloppy too. Like, you think of all the gangster films you've seen, right? They don't just leave bodies sitting around. They hide the bodies. Yeah. They bury the body. Yeah. They take them out to the desert, right? They, like, you they drop run them numbers. In the river. Like,
you want to run numbers. You want to run girls. You want to run racket. That's stuff that people can turn a blind eye to. You start dropping bodies, that's what eventually brings you down, you know?
Yeah.
So I agree. But again, the ultimate answer to everything Josto concerning is just, well, he's a terrible criminal.
Sure. Yeah, he's not amazing.
And I don't know how satisfying that's going to continue to be, but it remains a pretty good defense to the writing.
For sure.
We see the immediate impact when Calamita goes to visit Cannon's wife, Buell. And she's got this really smart organization going. She's teaching the kids syntax. She's homeschooling them. Seems like they're all paying attention. And he comes calling and points out immediately the lack of guards and is very threatening and like, where are the children? How many children you've got? And I thought her scene here where she pulls this sawed-off shotgun on him and gives this this cold smack about being a mama lion was amazing. I love Miss Cannon now.
Yeah, I feel like anybody right now can identify hard with her, because we got this pandemic going. So many kids are homeschooling at the moment, right? Doing this online training. And I get the impression that, like, the kids were going to the public schools, but since the war is on, they've had to be pulled out, right?
I was going to ask you that. It's like, what is the deal? Is it just that, like, the schools for black people in Kansas City are shit? So that, like, he's trying, they're doing some private education and stuff, or
I mean, I'm sure that
makes a lot of sense that, like, yeah, like, they're targets at the public school
for sure. Like, Lemuel was a target. There's a lot of bad things in the air right now, and so they probably pulled them out. So
why no guards though? That didn't make sense. Like,
I don't like this scene. I don't like it. I love her speech. Okay, I love her. Hate everything else about this scene, because Calamita is this weak nothing of a hitman. Like, and I don't know if he's doing that intentionally because he doesn't want to go kill a bunch of people and he's not working for Josto. And he knows that if he goes over there and starts killing a bunch of people, you know, Gaetano is going to get killed, who's the person he's actually working for. I don't know if that's the case, because none of it has been said. Mm. And I just get the impression that Calamita is an idiot who walked up to the door thinking, huh, no guard here, weird. I'm just going to stroll in I can't even conceive of what he was going to do here. What is his plan? Knock on the door and then ask how many kids are there?
Beat up this lady and push bully his way inside, which... But my thing is, like, but why isn't she guarded? Why aren't there dudes on that front porch? Because he had everybody dead. It just feels like that... I want to believe that Loy's really smart and competent and tough, and he seemingly commits so many unforced errors about, like, oh, well, we need all our dudes down in a fortress because we're going to entertain the Josto clan down there. But on the other hand, that's an obvious trap. Like, have one lone assassin go back to the house and whack everybody while you're taking this bogus bad faith offer from Josto. Like...
Here's the other thing they might be doing.
Get it. I don't get it. Yeah.
So one of the mantras, you know, that Gaetano was spouting earlier in the season, with the Italians at least, is business, family, country, right? In that order. And it feels like Loy is protecting his business, or his other family, right? His business family, more than he is his actual family. And this is all before he knows about Satchel, right? So he thinks the major going concern here is this war that's developing with the Fadas. He doesn't see Satchel as being in a huge threat at the moment. And so he's pulled everyone
that's
off.
A line that they won't cross. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
He maybe thinks they're smarter than they are.
I could be. It felt a little bit like Loy got flat footed, because if Calamita had been there with two dudes, that goes completely different, you know?
Yeah, Calamita does nothing that he's supposed to do this episode. Like,
right.
Giusto sends him in with orders to kill everyone you have to kill, including that's Zero, in my opinion.
Yeah. And that's the thing where it kind of works is that, like, the Fadas are just a complete house divided.
Yeah.
But they're all fools and incompetent, it seems.
And
like.
I can't tell if it's a foolish move here or if it's intentional sabotage, right?
No, I do think I disagree with your take on Calamita. I think Calamita is a killer and is pretty proficient at it. I don't think he's very good strategically or tact or, you know, or well.
So
I,
why
I
doesn't
guess,
he
yeah,
go in here and kill? Like,
I think you were right that he's not taking orders from Giusto. He's actually there trying to figure out whether his boss is still alive, because I guess his thought is like, well, if Gaetano is dead, then they probably already killed Zero. You know, like he's trying to investigate more for like, where is Irish there and has he taken the kid because he's doing this investigation. I don't think it's for Giusto though. I think it's for his own purposes.
Okay. That makes some amount of sense. It at least like pieces some of that puzzle together for me, because this was a big puzzle of the scene.
It's really tough when you're dealing with criminals that you don't fundamentally respect the intellect of, because, you know, they're so fucking random. It's kind of like I remember feeling this way about Bobby Cannavale in season 3 of Boardwalk Empire. It's like, this guy's so insane. It's kind of fun and interesting, but it also makes trying to figure out what the hell's going to go on completely pointless, because he's not a rational actor. It's like, is Joe Pesci going to laugh until he's blue in the face? Is he going to cut your face off in Goodfellas? I don't know. Like, it's like,
yeah,
who cares? It's like, it's a coin flip. So we did have a scene which I thought had some pretty nifty camera work of Calamita casing Irish's room and kind of like, you know, investigating it like a private detective. And he finds his personal Bible. And of course, wouldn't you know, there's a clue to be followed up there.
Uncle Jack's feed and seed.
What caught my eyes is based in Liberal, Kansas, which is not too far away, of course, from Kansas City. But I immediately stood out when I'm like, well, the material is very political in nature this year, and it's Liberal, Kansas. I'm going to look up to this. And Liberal, Kansas was founded by a settler by the name of Mr. Rogers. Fucking making this up. who became famous in the region for giving free water from travelers from his well. If people were thirsty, he just gave them, and people, I guess he decided to name the town because people would say, that's very liberal of you to share your resources with us like that. He went on to found the first general store and the post office in Liberal, Kansas. So like I said, being that this is, you know, there's a political bent to this story, I think it's kind of interesting that Irish is tied to this kind of Liberal, Kansas. Now, what the fuck? Is he literally going to be hiding out at Uncle Jack's feed store in Liberal, Kansas? Because if he is, I don't fucking know what to do or say. This seems like beyond stupid. But it's clearly a clue. Yeah. What's happening here? What's happening here, Jim?
I don't think there's any way around it. He's going to go out to Uncle Jack's feed and seed, and he's going to find Rabbi and Satchel.
I mean, sometimes you can get away with this. Like, the entire first Mission Impossible movie revolved around this goddamn Bible and this quote and this code from, like, you know, CompuServe message boards. And I defy anyone to this day to explain to me exactly how any of that plot connected in any kind of satisfying way. It's just a way for Tom Cruise to private dick his way into the third act. And I kind of feel the same way about this Calamita business, except for there wasn't a little layer of biblical codology laid on top of it. It's just literally, oh, look at this, Uncle Jack. But we'll see.
I mean, it's
we'll
in a Bible.
Maybe it'll be a wild.
I don't know. How much more biblical do you need it to be?
Maybe it'll be a wild. Maybe it'll be a wild seed chase. I don't know. Because So anyway. And then we also have the dissolving frame from this scene into the next scene of Giusto, where it's Gaetano he's chained up and he's being tortured and he's just nursing this hatred and this grudge towards his brother, which would land a whole lot better if I respected this guy's ability as anything. Like I'm not buying the story about him being this caged beast about to be unleashed, Jim. I really don't.
Even though he's talking about the people he killed, huh? Well, we assume, you know.
Yeah, maybe it's a lot easier to kill a man chained to a wall when you got the full force of like the Italian fascist apparatus behind you than it is to like, you know, win in a fair fight versus intelligent opponents, you know what I mean?
I mean, I guess for all we know, he's like talking about episodes of Italian Bonanza or something, like, oh, these are all the favorite moments where my characters died. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, this is the Italian Hitler comic book I used to read, and it's just completely delusional. So we cap off the FADA business by Jasto arriving at the cannon's heavily fortified headquarters. You know, Deffy described it as a fortress earlier in the episode. And there's Roland Force, like a bunch of dudes, 30, 40 dudes show up here, and the cannon boys are not plussed by any of this stuff. They say, you know what? Everybody stays out except for the consigliere and Jasto, Ebel and Jasto. So they come in and Ebel opens up and he's doing pretty well. He's trying to explain like how the political calculus is and like, you know, Gaetano, he's this and he's a made man. And then every single time he tries to make a point, Jasto comes in there with like, this is some people can't be killed. I don't know about all that.
It's great. Like I love him in this scene.
Yeah. It's effective, but he's good at being this thing, but is this thing good?
I think because it is in this scene because you need Lloyd to be able to figure out that he's lying. And I think
not just lying, but stupid.
And stupid, yeah.
And thinks that Lloyd's stupid.
Right. He's underestimated him, certainly. I think, yeah, like Jason Schwartzman's performance in this scene is exactly what it needed to be for me anyway. Because I believe that Loy would both take that initial punch in the face very seriously, right? That emotional gut punch of his son being dead. But then also have, you know, once he gets a moment and some distance away from that fact, be able to think about that conversation and go, you know, that doesn't quite make sense. And maybe this guy is full of shit. Jason Schwartzman wrote that line for me in a way that started to make me turn the corner on him in this season.
My problem is that like, I feel like Jasto comes out of his room thinking, man, I don't even know what this reference is because it hasn't been invented yet, but I'm Littlefinger in Game of Thrones, baby. I am a master manipulator. I have
absolutely
divided my opponent's forces. I've solved all the problems. I've squared things with New York and I've done it without shedding any of my own blood. If he really believes that, he's out of his goddamn mind. Like,
No, he's a buffoon. He's not very smart. Not as smart as he thinks he is, anyway.
Like, here's the thing. Like, at the end of this episode, I feel like that, you know, Noah Hawley's convincing me that Lloyd Cannon's got this in the bag, that he's got this mastermind plan. I really think Chris Rock could bend over, spread his butt cheeks, and fart, and just win. Like... I don't think these guys can fight their way out of a wet paper bag, man. I think that like he's not even going to need the old boy out of Fargo. Like he's just going to be able to take him on himself. It's with Dr. Senator 6 feet under. It don't matter.
Yeah.
These guys are just too fucking dumb to live.
That is fair. They have shown me zero strength from the Italian side of this equation. You know, the only strength has been coming from the Gaetano Calamita and really just Calamita side of it. And I don't like, you know, he's a free agent at this point. Like, I don't know what his deal is. He's just doing whatever he wants.
Right.
And probably loyal to Gaetano. But I don't know. Now Gaetano's out. So we'll see, you know, what they get up to now that they're paired back up.
Yeah.
Presumably.
Yeah. Well, we will definitely see because, like I said, I don't know what I'm going to think if Gaetano comes out madman, you know, just single-handedly taking down the FADA organization.
I mean, he's probably going to – I don't know what Joe Bulo's role is going to be in this. You know, they sent him in. They got some New York guys who are ready to go. if they can take care of this business quickly. And, you know,
plus Mr. Snowman's in that coffin and he's haunting black folk. Maybe that's the only way this idiot gang's going to win is if the supernatural comes and starts putting the kibosh on the cannons.
Yeah, like
that's it. You shouldn't have moved in on this. You picked the wrong goddamn funeral parlor to move in on, Loy. Uh-huh. Now you've got the spirits of the dead against you. What are you going to do? So yeah, that pretty much concludes. And the other thing about this, just to underline it, is Evil cannot, but he's out of it. He's having an out of body experience this entire conversation.
Yeah,
seeing what his boss is trying to pull.
And I'm happy that they didn't have him go further with that. You know, him saying boss is like, it says everything. It says everything you need to know about what's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I was aghast with him at what I was seeing happening.
Yeah.
So, there's a little bit of connective police business I think we can do now. Wef is underneath the bridge. He is trying to get the courage to go rush into Loy's place.
Hmm.
Or maybe he needs to report back to him the fact that he wasn't able to do his mission. Either way, Marshal Deffy decides to slide in and essentially blows him up. Says, I know that you are as crooked as any cop in this town and you've been working both sides, and you're kind of declares himself as an enemy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but not one who's gonna like move in, you know. Who's going to make any moves. He says, what's up?
Do you think he leaves Kansas City without squaring things with Wef, though? That's the thing that I don't think Wef thinks that, because he goes to pack his bags after his confrontation. But that line where it's like, you know, if I knew where your Mormon God was, I'd drive through the night and stab him in his fucking eyes. And that's declaring war. And I don't think you want to declare war with this guy. I really don't.
No, no.
He's all too serious of a character.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy who will, you know, tie people to the back of his car and drag them through the streets till their heads pop off. Like,
yep. And it's like, you know, this thing is like, be careful how many sides you play. Even a gold coin, it has two faces. To be fair, Wef is not, you know, he has not divided his sides willingly. You know,
no, he's not playing anything. So. He's being played.
Yeah. There's a really interesting thematic point here that after Deffy steps out of his car, Otis Wef slaps himself, not as customary 5 times, but 6.
Yeah. I didn't make anything of this. The 6th Indian
has been deployed. You didn't?
No. Like, I saw people talking about it. I'm like, I don't care. It's not that maybe there's not something there. I just don't care. Like,
all right, fair enough.
It's so minor. Fair enough. It's so fucking minor. And Wef is not a character who's like consequential at any point during any of this stuff so far. So
yeah, and there's like if they're trying to, it's, I just think it's further underlining, you know, his fracturing. But they're also doing that, like, he's noticeably more jumpy. This is you know, all of his various neurotypicalness is like coming together and converging with his highly stressful situation to cause him a lot of problems. He has this fantasy sequence where I'm not sure if this is an imaginary thing or if it's a flashback to something that real happened, but his fiance, you know, cradling his head on her lap while she sings this hymn to him, and he wakes up from it and decides to just go rabbit, packs up his bag, packs up his Alpine Shepherd boys, and blows out of there just to be snatched up by Loy's gang.
Yeah, which I knew was coming, but I liked how it happened.
I knew it was happening. I just didn't know who it was going to be. I didn't know if it was going to be Deffy's shadow, Calamita's shadow, or one of you know, Loy's dudes' shadows.
And when he tries to play it tough, and he's like, "No, I don't get in your car. You get in my car." And they're like, "All right,
fine by me." They all pile in. Yeah, I'll have a white dude drive us or escort us around town. That'd be just nice.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole, like, you can't just sneak up on police officers. Gotta even the odds somehow.
Yep.
They're a bunch of characters. That kicks off the canon business. Start off with Leon. Loy calls it trying to shit his bed all the way to the top.
All the way to the top. Yep.
You're trying to shit your bed up to the top, I love it. I have never heard that expression in my life. It's amazing. I love it.
It's perfect. It evokes the image of like him sleeping in a crib almost, right? Like he's a child shitting the thing all the way full. Yeah.
Yeah, can't crawl out of it himself. He's just got to shit his way to the top and roll off. Oh my God. And I do think this is a deliberate reference to his Pootie Tang. Have you seen Pootie Tang?
No.
Oh my God. Pootie Tang is this low budget thing that he did with, I think, am I imagining this or Louis C.K.? Like in the mid 90s. And it's just like, it was like a parody of a blaxploitation film with this hero called Pootie Tang, who is given this mystical leather belt by his daddy. And legend was, if he always used this belt in a righteous manner, he could whip anyone's ass with it.
Oh boy. Okay. And
Chris Rock laying into Leon was channeling the power of Pootie Tang. I think anyway. Huh. It's a great scene. Like, I'm not sure what they're trying to say with this, because you know Leon, it comes out. I guess he is an important part of the black crime syndicate in the Midwest.
Yeah, he's like the nephew of somebody, right? Somebody important they're gonna need.
Yeah. Exactly. He's like cheese in The Wire. You know, like he's the nephew of Proposition Joe.
Okay.
It's like Proposition Joe is a solid guy, but his cheese is kind of a fuck up. And you get that feeling from this guy. And Lloyd's just not having it. What's this guy's arc?
I don't know, because every time we see him, he's talking about the brains he's got, and I don't know that he's been given an opportunity to show the brains, but he's certainly been given an opportunity to show donkey brains, and he does that by, you know, taking a Lemuel to the club and letting him do his thing,
put him in a position where the man can pinch him.
So we've seen that he's not like super smart, and you knew this was coming, right? Like they did that delayed sort of gratification with the talking to that Leon was going to get from Loy. And here it is.
Oh yeah, it definitely came.
Yeah, and you know, part of this is just the anger that he feels over Dr. Senator being dead. Part of this is because he's, I guess, got to put this kid in his place, let him know that he's not as much of a brainiac as he thinks.
Yeah. Loy is very sensitive to Dr. Senator's name being in people's mouths that are not worthy to speak at this episode, which I really liked. Then the phone rings and I love, like, Loy Cannon, like out of breath from whipping this guy's ass, like on the phone and saying you can meet him. I presume this is Josto setting up the meet, right?
Yeah.
And the whole mystery you better believe is going to cost you. I guess we didn't mention the stakes of that meeting, that like the offer was the Stockyards and two lucrative routes. I think one to Chicago, one to Dallas, for Gaetano straight up, or to kill Gaetano.
Yeah. To kill Gaetano instead of killing Zero, right? Like that's the cover there is take this lesser Zero, death. Yeah.
I don't know. Does Josto think he can sell that to New York? But the thing is that's the thing. It doesn't matter because Josto's a fool.
Yeah.
And then there's like really great. I think Chris Rock did some really good performance here with these flashbacks. It reminds me of like Michael Corleone being haunted by the death of his brother. Yeah. You know, like at the end of The Godfather 2, just thinking about all that stuff, except for like Loy's apparently much more affected by it. And he's playing through all these promises he made to Satchel and Satchel not wanting to go through this. There's this really powerful scene where he's like psyching himself up to strangle this kid with a fucking jump rope, which
dark.
Chris Rock had that gear to him too.
It's a dark Christmas, man. That is rough. Like, I love that shot with him sitting on the couch, the Christmas lights behind him, just illuminating the background, and him almost in complete darkness there as he contemplates what to do. Yeah, it's great.
Do we want to second guess Loy as a criminal? Because the other thing I want to talk about is, like, it doesn't seem smart to let Ebel and Josto walk out of that room. Like, it feels like at this particular, like, one of those dudes had to die, probably Ebel. Like, that's eye for an eye, right? You know, you take out my consigliere, take out yours.
maybe I don't know. Like the speech he gives later, about them trying to drag you down, you know, it turn you into, get you in the mud with them, is very much on his mind, and is very much why I think he shows the restraint there, because he knows that like that's a move that you don't come back from, right? Then he goes to war with New York. Then he goes to war with anybody who's left in that organization. It might be like a justified move, but it is definitely not the right move if he wants to stay alive and keep his business.
Yeah, it's, man, it's just really interesting to try to play like the and I always think about this in terms of criminal organizations, where it's like, you know, if you've got, you know, kind of like the best you can hope for case, like, you know, old man Corleone, you know, before Michael took over, Vito. Like, he's like this almost a benevolent duke, you know. He looks over his neighborhood, and yeah, some people get killed, but you're not going to get killed if you're not in the game. He's going to look after you, and you're going to get a Christmas goose delivered to your doorstep, and everything's fine. Because this guy, because he's got lines, you know, he's not going to do drugs, he's not going to murder children.
Yeah.
But then every once in a while, you might have to. And like, it feels like when criminals are given that choice, like, you know, it's like, well, are you going to become a monster or you're not? There's like two ways you can go. Like, well, I'm not going to do it. In which case, eventually someone that will, that's not as good as you, is going to take over. And then what happens? So then you can rationalize, well, like, I'll murder this child because I'll at least feel bad about it and I'll minimize it. And if I let the real animals take over, then what happens? But how many times can you do that before you turn into... You know, it's just, and then you got this.
Yeah. Obviously, we deal with this stuff in the modern day, right? Nothing has changed. It's how we play our political games now. It's how we play our business games. It's how we play our crime games. All that stuff is the same. And all of it is not even a slippery slope. It's like, it's an arms race, right? You have to do the things that other people are doing. Otherwise, they beat you, and they do the things tenfold. So,
and it all seems very rational. Like, every time I read up, like, to the buildup of World War One, and I'm like, well, what would I have done differently? You know, like, and almost the only answer is, well, cooler head should have prevailed this time. But, like... You know, when you just get in this runaway brinksmanship, it's like, you know, and you're like, well, if you show this whole thing's based on shows of strength. So if you do show that weakness, then it's.
Yeah, you almost need to have a balance of power that somehow is unable to get out of whack. Right. Like I think about the Cold War and using nuclear missiles or the potential threat of that.
Yeah, like a higher power prevents us from doing it, literally.
Right, mutually assured destruction. Like, if we go there, they're going to go there, and it's going to be game over forever.
Metaphysical certainty that you cannot win is the only thing that will save you.
Right.
Man, the thing is, like, the smart people to see the balance of power are quick to be deposed by the foolish that don't and see the value of the balance. But it's wild, and I really appreciate Chris Rock getting to do this, like, really paint with this palette, because I was really impressed with the work he was doing with the death of Satchel, and I wonder what they're going to do with this energy they built that's based on a lie, you know? Like, when Satchel's revealed, like, what is that going to be like for Chris Rock? And, man, there's just some exciting dramatic storytelling potential that they've built by spending 20 minutes building this emotional pressure that doesn't get relieved.
Well, let me ask you this. What if Calamita goes out to Uncle Jack's feed and seed? And rather than putting the kibosh on old Rabbi and Satchel, he brings Satchel back to Loy. Does that just, like, totally fuck Josto, which is kind of what he would want to do?
Yeah, but
I don't.
The thing is,
I don't know,
like,
if
that's an interesting play, but like, what's Gaetano think about that? Although, like, what you just said makes me think, like, I can see a world where Calamita is the boss. Like, I've been thinking it's going to be
or Gaetano.
How can he get beat?
Like, if the word gets back
Gaetano.
To New York about that, like.
Gaetano,
totally
I can't
him.
Accept because like he's just a terror, but Calamita, like I think he is smarter about the way he plays politics. Maybe not as smart as he need him to be. I don't know. I feel bad. Like, I don't want to contemplate where a world where the stupid people win.
Yeah.
Even though that does happen from time
to time. I don't know that they can beat Loy, right? I think Loy is smarter than the whole lot of them. But yeah. I think the Calamita could throw a monkey wrench into Jasto's plans with New York and end up with either himself or Gaetano as the boss there in Kansas City.
Yeah, and there's always the thing to consider, the theory that Satchel is Mike Milligan. If that's true, and Mike Milligan's high ranking in the Kansas City Mafia, then it implies some kind of, if not victory by Cannon's people, some fusion that comes out of this. It's not going to be, you know, all one way or all the other. But, I thought that they did a really good job of building up the tension, the emotional tension leading the Chris Rock, or not Chris Rock, the Loy Cannon telling his wife about it and, like, you know, her primal scream. I thought that was really, really well done.
Yeah, for sure.
There's also this amazing scene where Cannon's being driven around to go meet with Wef, and he has him pull over because he sees this sign of the banking establishment rolling out the Diners Club, the first the first credit card, and just this, he spent a sleepless night, and just like, like that, yeah, if you want a dictionary definition of bone tired, world weary, it's Chris Rock in this scene. I felt it, like, just the, just like, fuck, man, why even try anything?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know where that goes. I don't know if that's just, like, you know, a knife in his side, just something to really just dig at him, or if that's going to go somewhere.
Extra fire in the belly, yeah. If nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're in the Cannon's boxing gym, and Wef has been, you know, hauled off, as we talked about in the police business. And Zalmare and Swanee kind of blow through. They have a nice little scene where they just intimidate the fuck out of poor jumpy Wef.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, like I said, there's some really good dialogue where Swanee gets to talk about how old she is and her native tongue. And they talk about the nature of being a girl and being wanted. But then Loy comes in there. And again, I think this is part of the plot. Like, he tells Wef to cover his ears. Wef is going to hear everything that they're saying, right? That's got to be intentional.
Probably.
Like, I think that Cannon's counting on him to inform, you know, his various bosses and people about this plan, specifically to draw out maybe this marshal. I think Loy sees this marshal as like a wild card, and he wants to reign. He also, the thing that's like really putting pressure over his man, Wef. I think this is going to be a trap for him, seems like to me.
I hadn't read that much into it, but I could see that, yeah. Like, I don't know, I could see a lot of things, because clearly they want us to think Loy's got a plan, and it's a very smart one, and it's one that the audience hasn't quite yet figured out.
This has got to be a part of it, I think. And I think they'll definitely play their part, too. I love Swanee's remark about it's been a sad parade.
It sure right? has.
When she's about ready to blow out of town.
Yeah.
And then, like, Chris Rock gives another, I think he's given 6 of these speeches so far this season. Well, he's given 4. Dr. Senator's given 2.
Mm-hmm.
Where he talks about, like, you know, he tries to explain to a white person the struggles of a black man in the country and the trap where, like, you try to tell a person they're an animal and they're not human, but you stand tall like a man, and eventually they give up and they get in the mud and they show you how to be like that. And then if you get down in there with you, then they stand up and then say, see, you're exactly what we thought you were.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a speech. I do wonder, like, what is the because we're getting like one of these an episode, and they do, like, some of them feel like I remember in that first episode where it felt like it was definitely arguing for something from a conservative point of view, which you don't hear a lot in Hollywood.
What is that? Can you explain that? Because I don't know that I'm familiar with what you're
saying. That speech he gave about, like, the drug addict, where he said, you know, see this man, he doesn't have a future, but if you give him money, he's got a future, and now I can take it away from him, all that. Like, That was, I felt like an economic argument from a very fundamentally conservative point of view. And I think this, like, this is the argument against, like, well, you know, the whole thing about black people is, like, they just, like, you know, why don't they just fucking integrate into society? You know, if they would make an effort, if they'd make an effort.
Yeah, and this is the argument. It's like, well,
no, I mean, like, you know, look at the civil rights marches, like those people. And I think I've said it in, on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at those pictures, like, these are not like these people look like Ozzie and Harriet and Ward and June Cleaver. They're in their church the Sunday going best, and they got their smart hats and their suits, and they're getting the fuck beat out of them by white people with batons and fire hoses and dogs. You know, look at Loy's gang versus Cannon's gang, Loy's gang versus Josto's gang. Mm-hmm. They are pretty, as other than the color of the skin, they're largely indistinguishable as far as their clothes and all that. Yeah. You know, fast forward in 2020, you know, look at Russian gang versus like a, you know, Bloods and the Crips versus, I don't know, the remnants of the mafia. It's all it's all over the place. But like,
sure.
I think this is like, this argument is blowing that up. And that's why I keep on saying, like, I feel like there's something in all these speeches that they're dismantling a certain type of like, well, you know, we've moved past race type of argument in America by showing it happening in the past. When it's like, it's hard to find a person saying, well, in 1950s America, there was no racial component to any of this stuff. It was all colorblind, right? So I don't know.
Oh, but, yeah. Oh, well, I don't think it's hard to find those people. I think those people imagine a past America as from their own perspective as being better than, you know, how it is now. And what I think, yeah, they're trying to say here is, you're right, that it's the same. It's always been like this. We've never actually changed much of anything. And yeah, if you're thinking of like the America that was great, well, you're living in a fantasy land because it never existed for a bunch of people.
Yeah. Like Fargo seems to be articulating a lot of these arguments that are like, there was this argument that was like going on in like the 90s and even up until like just very recently, especially in like middle white America, that like racism is a problem we used to have.
Yeah.
And we solved everything in the civil rights and everything's hunky dory now. And I feel like this is making these arguments over and over again that's not true, by inviting you to, you know, see the parallels between now and then. And like, you know, how much, like, there's been a lot of, like, you know, obviously the times are very different in terms of style and whatnot, but in terms of like what people are struggling with, not so much.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like I said, the do it this much and this often and every have a set piece conversation in every episode. It's almost like Noah Hawley is trying to address those arguments, but it's weird because like, if you don't see it, I don't think you would see it. Like I'm thinking of like, if I'm at the dinner table with Thanksgiving this year and I'm arguing with my uncle, and this is not going to happen because of COVID, but like, and you know, he's going like, oh, this racism and it's colorblind and blah, blah, blah. If I'd be like, well, you see, if with this mafia in Kansas City in the 1950s, if like this, it's like, it's a great form of an argument, but I don't know that it actually translates to the real world. But I think that's what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
The other thing is like, there's like three different like monologues in the one. There's the thing that he has about the racism, but then there's also the, in America, we have our own type of criminal, the confidence man, because America's full of dreamers and dreamers you can fleece. Mm-hmm. Like they rob themselves. I thought that was really powerful too. But it's also at odds with, I feel like the Loy Cannon that gave the speech to the drug addict would not give the speech about the dreamers and how you can fleece them. It's weird for me from that perspective. But anyway, he concludes his argument with asking Wef, you know, what are we going to do about this? So there's another thing, like, I don't know how explicitly he's going to bring Wef into his plan, or if he's going to use Wef and assume that Wef is going to be a weasel and, you know, like essentially tie a torch to his tail and send him running through his enemy's vineyards to set fire to it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Seems like that the latter would be the smart play.
We'll see.
Then he gets rid of Gaetano. He sets Gaetano free after letting him know that Josto was going to pay me to kill you, essentially.
Yeah, and this, you know, the motto of life for life kind of thing is showing that he's not getting in the mud with him, right?
Yeah. I think
it's a contrast, right? The Italians have this life for life concept. He's not going to go there, even though he thinks that his son is dead. Like, it's a big deal.
Yeah, and he's going to let all of his enemies get down into the mud and drown themselves. Is I think what's going to be the strategy here.
Yeah,
is that you know. There's like four different sides there, and they're all going to shoot each other to pieces. We'll see. And the other thing is that he's only keeping, I thought it was also interesting that he's only keeping the stockyards. Like, hey, you can keep the trucking rats, which I don't, because like I said, I think he thinks that he's going to destroy them and take everything. Like, whatever he's set, whatever motion thing, plan he's set in motion here is going to be the checkmate. So.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Any other comments, or because I think that brings all of our business to a close here, Jim.
Yeah, let's get into the feedback.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Okay, you can send us feedback at fargo@baldmove.com, or you can get on our forums, forums.baldmove.com, to talk with your fellow fans on a weekly basis. Killer Toast here brought something to my attention. It was a thread on the Fargo TV subreddit, Farget V. I had a question about that painting and what it meant.
You're talking about the painting in Chris Rock's office, house, I don't know where it is.
Yeah.
With the black man with the sword who's beheaded at a black man.
Yeah. So this painting is called The Summary Execution Under the Moorish Kings of Granada, and it was painted by this particular Frenchman, and it was like this painting is considered the epitomization of what's called the Orientalist movement, which was this artistic wave in like the 17th and 18th centuries where they fetishized like Middle Eastern and Muslim culture. Like there was this like intense eroticism of like the harem culture and like in a fascination of focus on the exoticness of the culture. and like this painting, this heightened, like, you know, they don't fuck around with courts of law. It's like the king says off with his head, and whoosh, off with his head. But it's also like this, like, you do this, like, anytime, obviously, you eroticize and exoticize a culture, you're intentionally othering that culture.
Sure.
And I thought there was some interesting discussion around that. Like, you know, this is a story about what happens when people stop trying to understand each other and just kind of go with their assumptions and, like, lean into those. And I thought maybe that's what they're trying to say here with that.
It absolutely could be. Like, that, if that's not the state of our world currently, I don't know what is.
Right, right.
So if Holly's trying to write something relevant, that could be a good angle.
Yeah, like, you know, like, what are you looking for? You're looking for the similarities that bind us or the differences that divide us.
Yeah.
Andy B says, I don't know if it's been brought up, but I just realized this is the first season of Fargo that doesn't have a police officer as the main protagonist for the audience to sympathize with. Given the strong and clear racial themes of the season, I think it makes a bit of sense, as neither the black nor the Italian citizens, being subjugated populations, would trust the police to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
So in season one, you obviously had Deputy Molly Salverson. Season two, you had Lou Salverson, her father, with her grandpa, Hank Larson. And in season three, had Gloria Burgle, of course. I mean, I think this is like, you can make this argument, right? But on the other hand, you do have Deffy and Officer Weff, who are definitely point of view characters. And if you say they're not the main characters, I would ask you, who the hell is?
Yeah, because it's fair. Like, Loy. Loy is, like, a number one main character.
Loy is
definitely
the number one character. Yep. But is he the, like, it's, this is kind of, this is a much more Game of Thronesy season where, yeah, you've got families and dynasties as Papa, Jesus Christ, I forgot all of my
Lannister
lore. Lannister, Charles Dance, Jesus, as he would say, dynasties. You got all this stuff, and, like, you know, it's real hard. It's real hard to make your way all the way around the map of Westeros sometimes, and Ethelreda gets pushed through the margins.
Yeah.
So, like, you are, I think you're correct, but I'm not sure, like, how much of it's thematic because the theme makes sense, and how much of it is just there's really not a central character thus far.
My only real theory coming out of that is that Zero is Robin. That's my only real theory.
Fair enough. Let's move on. Aaron K says, I just discovered this podcast. I think you both are great. Well, thanks,
Thank
Aaron.
You.
Like the name, too. Really interesting analysis and discussions. I've personally been enjoying the season. I like to know a Holly tries something different with each one. Maybe it's not always 100% successful this season, but about 90% of the time it works for me. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm the same way. Like, I'll forgive Holly for going off road every once in a while and really jarring our ride with the rough suspension, because he swings for the fences 100% of the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you're going to strike out when you're taking those big cuts out of the air. But I prefer that. I prefer that to someone just safely, you know, delivering up mediocrity. Right.
Sure.
Aaron continues. One of the characters we haven't seen much, but someone I've been looking out for is Ebel. The Kansas City Mafia we know in season two operates more like a corporation than a traditional criminal organization. My theory is Ebel is going to end up as one of the people who forms that criminal organization in season two. The first two episodes of the season, he offers Harvard money in exchange for letting them into the hospital and advises Josto to wait and be patient till they kill Harvard. The last episode, you could see that he was actually shocked and even a little sad that Doc was killed, of course. He's not as much of a hot-headed gangster like Josto and Gaetano. He even seems to want the war to end and both sides to reach some sort of truce. He's not exactly what you would call corporate, but I can see how the seeds could be planted where he sees so much bloodshed and messes to clean up that he wants to operate more like a business than a mafia. I think Gaetano, Calamita, Josto, and most of the Fadas will be dead at the end of the season. Ebel, along with Joe Bulo, maybe some members of the previous Jewish and Irish gangs, will form the Kansas City Mafia we know in season two. I guess I never thought about the remnants of, like, the Jewish and Irish gangs still kicking around. What do you think of that?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of like it. we don't know anything about Joe Bulow in this time period, really, other than he exists. So I don't know if he could start this whole thing himself. Actually, I'm pretty sure like he doesn't. He gets promoted to where he's at somewhere along the line. But yeah, I could see like if anybody's going to make it out of this, it's going to be the smart guys. And Ebel is one of the smartest on the Italian side for sure.
Yeah, they're. I wonder if they're trying to suggest, like, the Kitchen Brothers. They had those little round hats that kind of like look like some branch of Orthodox Judaism. Is there like they're suggesting there's some kind of vestigial, you know, Rabbi Milligan influence there with Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers?
Maybe
that might be interesting. That might be interesting. And I could definitely see it, but. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that Ebel makes it out. I really like it.
Yeah, is this a tragedy? Because if it is, then yeah, he doesn't make it out. Because I really want him to.
Although I guess you're right. Like, because I think, well, Loy, you know, he's got a pretty good head on his shoulders. But it would be interesting if like Dr. Senator's friend is what makes it out, and they do have some kind of like this fusion gang that I keep on thinking. Like, I can't tell if, like, the Loy's going to win outright or there's going to be some kind of fusion. And this talk of, like, remnants of the Irish and Jewish. And, like, that would be it'd be another kind of, like, really right-on thematic thing that, like, the Kansas City Mafia is literally a melting pot.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, a little bit ironic, too, though, because it's still a criminal organization, right? It says kind of a lot about America. I don't know. That could be real interesting.
Tommy, North Carolina, I had a half-assed thought about WEF. I agree with you both that WEF's knock, tick, tell is clearly foreshadowing some event, maybe even a critical turn in the plot, maybe just his own demise. As Aaron pointed out, we've already seen people ventilated through a closed door. Mm-hmm. But what if WEF's knock, tick, tell started after he was discharged honorably, and he does it to warn the ghosts in the room that he knows they are there, that he's about to enter, and to please, for the love of God, go away?
Whoa. Huh. I mean, he's seeing ghosts this episode.
True Detective season 3 blend with a little bit of Mr. Snowman. That would be interesting. I think that, like, you're going to... He talks about that he had this method that kept him safe. Mm-hmm. Like, that he never deviated from. And I think it's something... Part of his method was some kind of counting thing, and it's this one little, two little, three little, like he, like, yeah. I don't know, that's that kept him, like, how many paces he was going into the field, and he had some kind of grid coordinate that was all mapped out the Indians around him. I don't know, but I do think that that's what we're going to find out. It's as something to his mind clearing methodology. How that relates to the five knocks, I don't know. I do like this idea that he's essentially banishing ghosts.
Yeah. So, I mean, it calls into question, did he see the ghost of his dead wife at that point, or his fiance, whatever? Or was that a flashback? Was that, I don't know. Another possibility, he actually sees her there in the room.
That dovetails in with Tommy's half-assed prediction. He says that he thinks it'll be WEF who encounters this phantom. Because for whatever reason, a moment of panic or clarity or a final act, he enters a room without knocking and doesn't scare the ghost off.
Okay.
We'll see. They got you down.
Right.
Got you down. Got the prediction down in the books. Claim your internet points at the end of the season if you're right there, Tommy. Paul says, hey, guys, I was listening to an audiobook the other day and heard it mentioned that D.W. Bliss, the doctor that treated President Garfield after he was shot, was legally named Dr. Willard Bliss.
Wow.
Apparently his parents wanted to name him after Dr. Samuel Willard, but didn't realize that Dr. Willard was the man's title and last name rather than his first and last names.
Oh, no.
D.W. Bliss's parents were stupid. They're real dumb. Real dumb.
And yeah, look at how far he went.
At the dawn of medicine, that's not like, who the hell knew what a doctor was? Like, that's like literally in the last... We haven't had doctors for hundreds and hundreds of years, right?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you when the term doctor was invented.
Because before doctor, we invented doctors, or they invented themselves. We just had, like, fucking...
Healers, right?
Well, I forget. It's no, it's like your the butcher or your barber would do a lot of this shit. Like your barber would take off a bad toe or knock out your tooth or stuff like that. Yeah, people involved like you know, have like sharp implements and know how to deftly use razors and whatnot and knives.
Your gardeners, that you'd... your barbers.
Yeah, yeah, gardeners, barbers, butchers. Professional swordsmen. They're all. Need a vasectomy.
You have to be a knight to take off the queen's toe, though.
Yeah. So maybe these I'm being too hard on the Bliss family. Like they invented doctors and started calling people. And they hey, you know these doctors. I respect this doctor guy. So name him our kid after him. Anyway, appreciate the historical tidbit, Paul. Carolyn, small detail from this week's show when Antoon said he ate his boots/shoes and was about to eat his belt. I was thinking, wouldn't the person eat their belt before they ate their footwear? Or is a belt actually more valuable? Interested to hear your thoughts on this small, pointless detail.
That's a good point. I would certainly eat my belt before I ate my shoes.
I mean, but what if your pants are falling down all the time?
I'll eat my pants. Skinny. Fuck it.
Eat your pants? Yeah. Because, like, you know, like, that's the order.
Belt,
shoes.
Belt, pants, shirt, overcoat, shoes. that's the five-course meal that I'm having.
My only thought is you could run around and away from people out of danger if you're not wearing shoes, but if you got no belt and you get up to run and they just fall to your ankles and trip you.
I'm telling you, eat your pants. Problem solved. My legs don't get cold anyway.
Did you know, so apparently this is true. You can actually boil leather and eat it and get nutritional value because it is an animal product.
I have
it's not a lot.
Yeah.
It's not great. And like modern tanned leather has got a lot of chemicals in it that will be bad for you. But if it's that or starve, eating that stuff was, I went down a whole rabbit hole about like what people did starvation tactics. Cause I guess a lot of the old wallpaper used to have like paste that was essentially flour, and gluten, and that like in certain areas in like Eastern Europe when the starvation was really bad, people were peeling the wallpaper off their walls to like make stews that are essentially like this glue soup. Like, fuck, man. Yeah, it's amazing what you do when you're hungry and you're just trying to stave off. It's like that poem that they were reading, or that the Kipling's The Jungle. Where the guy is like, you know, that's the whole, they do like what the bizarreness of starving in a modern city, like how crazy it is. Moving on to Chris from Sydney, loving your work and usually agree with your breakdowns. However, I think you're missing a point on Josto doing your critiquing of him in the episode 6 podcast. I think a big point that you're forgetting is that he was born into this life. He inherited the life as crime and being a crime boss. So it's not a mistake that he doesn't seem or feel legit. They're showing as little self-entitled, spoiled brat of a kid who is now at the helm of this organization, forever trying to prove that he belongs and should be respected as the boss of his family.
Okay. I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, my only problem I have is to really be engaged in a story, you got to have respect for both sides, you know, like unless it's a farce, and Fargo can be a farce. Like, don't get me wrong. Like that's, and it's been a farce already this season.
Yeah.
You know, like if the going back to the Game of Thrones example, if the Starks and Lannisters weren't competent, you didn't respect them. Then there's no tension when they go to war, they square off. It's like, well, it's going to be one side getting bullied, right?
Yeah, they'd be Greyjoys. And, sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's like, I guess that's my problem is like, if I don't respect Gaetano or Josto, and I have like, they're showing me that there's a lot of respect here that I should give to Loy Cannon, like, where is this going to go, you know? So.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly well within the Coen's wheelhouse to do a farce and have a bunch of characters doing really stupid stuff. And them pointing out how stupid it is, I could see it if that's just what they want to do this season. I guess I'm on board.
And I keep coming back to Loy saying he's not just fighting this war, he's fighting a mindset. And it'd be so fucking Fargo for him to win and then just get rolled up by the law, you know, because there's a black man in the street shooting. And then you could see, like, you know, Mike or Rabbi Milligan and Satchel in hiding able to rebuild from some kind of seed, you know.
Yeah, I mean, half of me expected that, when he let Gaetano go, that Gaetano would, like, slip on his own blood and break his neck on a chair or something as he's leaving, right? Like, that's well within the performance envelope of this show.
As he says, "Mamma mia," and breaks his bag. Yeah.
Yeah.
David says, "Longtime club member, infrequent mailer. Love to hear from you, David. Finally caught up to episode 406 as well as the podcast and want to touch on two quick things. My first take is something minor, although I totally agree that the capture the capture of Gaetano rather was ham-fisted. The fact that he would not have felt the cold air from the open window behind him is believable. His adrenaline was way up, and speaking from experience, it's easy to miss those kind of details when you're that hopped up. Otherwise, I did find it odd that Cannon's people were not on hand to help with the recovery and that the shot to the back of the head wasn't a fatal. It's a bit of disappointment in what is otherwise a cool set piece." Yeah, we didn't touch on that, but I was briefly so happy when I thought his brains just got blown out. I'm like, what a twist. Halfway through the season, I'm like beside myself with this character, and Holly just blows his brains out. he's still breathing. It's a good five seconds, though. It's a real good 5 seconds. I was genuinely delighted.
I mean, that's the thing. He's not wrong about this, right? Like, the adrenaline is a definite factor. Like, you see all the time and you forgive it and you're like, you understand it. And you're like, okay, cool. When characters will get shot during the heat of a battle and not even realize that they've been shot.
Not even know it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I get it for sure.
Yeah. It cuts both ways. Like, you know, the adrenaline slowing things down and making you hyper observant and all that versus flooding you with irrelevant information.
Mm-hmm.
His second take is to join in the opinion that the ghost isn't a malevolent spirit. So far, it hasn't hurt anyone. It can even be interpreted as it helped Swanee, not hurt her. She did, after all, wake up. I also think this is a bit of an accord with Fargo, given the news or the show's intended quirkiness and liberal taking of left turns when a right turn is expected. I that's what I'm thinking. Like, it's a big subversion. This is a big scary ghost. What if he's actually good?
Could be.
Or benevolent. Sure does look menacing, though.
Yeah, he does.
Also, he's a white ghost. They're gonna have a white ghost save the black people at the end of this season. Is that what we're gonna do? We're gonna have a magical white person be the one that's I don't know how well that sets.
Good point.
Whitney writes in, says, "So happy you're back with Fargo. I've missed listening to you both. It's a weird time, however, to watch this particular season. I'm watching on Hulu the next day, like most, and the subtext / hypertext is just too real."
Yeah.
When Chris Rock pulls over and sees the diner club card and just shakes his head, I cried. I should say that this is written by a black American. Mm-hmm. Because they then say, because that's how most black Americans feel every day. Yeah. It's been a hard year, and I look to this show for some funny accents and outrageous violence and comeuppance. So I just wonder how non-black Americans are viewing the season. Do you find it relentless? Even Hanzi felt like he could succeed and fight back. All his slights seem to be eventually punished, like in the bar scene. Thanks for making this somewhat fun with your commentary, at least. Whitney in Philadelphia. What do you think? As a non-black person, Jim, how's the season hit?
I mean, it hits on the nose for me. Like, I understand what they're putting down there. I get it. But, you know, like, black people in America, white people in America are not a monolith. So I imagine there are a lot of white people who are looking at this, scratching their heads, going, I don't get it. What are they trying to say? You know, I thought we had dealt with all this.
I don't know, man. That actually kind of motivates me is anytime I start feeling down, I'm like, well, Jesus Christ, I'm a straight white dude. Can I give in to despair? Like, what the hell have I seen? You know, my next door neighbor is this 73-year-old former black Marine military police officer, and I can tell he's pretty conservative in his viewpoints, mm-hmm. but he's also pretty fucking fed up with some of the shit he's seen, especially with the policing. And, you know, and he worries about his kids and he worries about his grandkids and he worries about, you know, him getting older and being able to keep up with everything. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, Derek gets out of bed every morning and goes about his business. I can't not, you know,
right.
So, Yeah, it'd be a sad day in America if black folks just give up. Like, I don't know. Maybe that'll galvanize us. Like, oh shit, we can't rely on these people to be like dependably fighting for rights for everybody. We got to pick up the slack. Maybe, but like, it's gonna be a grim day. It's gonna be a grim day.
And so I don't know.
Is that infuriating? Is that infuriating to hear, Whitney?
Yeah.
I'm sure. Is that make you feel good? Is it anything? I don't know.
I really appreciate
you listening to us.
Yeah. If you wanted to listen more of that, because it sounds like maybe you haven't tuned in since our last Fargo season, which was years ago. We've covered a few other shows that might be relevant since then, like Watchmen, maybe The Deuce. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff in there that we've covered that you might enjoy.
On the other hand, if you're coming to television for ha-has and laughs, maybe not.
Oh, yeah, you can avoid
maybe
those.
Not those particular shows.
Right.
Expanse is really cool. Escapist material.
Sure.
I like that show. But yeah, no, I appreciate the comments, Whitney. And I don't know, man. We'll things have been worse. Things have been better. We'll get through this together. That'll do it for our feedback this episode. Fargo@baldmove.com is where you want to put those comments in. If you got anything to say, or again, the forums, forums.baldmove.com is also there 24 hours a day to hear your thoughts. That will do it for this week. I've read from a lot of people, a lot of the television critics that I respect that I've seen most of the season. I think a lot of them, like Sepinwall, have seen 10 out of the 11 episodes.
Oh.
That there's universally said that these last two episodes, where they've obviously kind of cobbled together to do something, were like the roughest, and it's supposed to kind of quote unquote get better. So if you've liked even these last two episodes, then the back half of this season feels like it's going to be a real barn burner.
Yeah.
I gotta say, like, it's been a long time since I've been looking forward to seeing a postseason like interview with a showrunner as much as I'm looking forward to seeing whoever Holly talks to after this season, because I am with child to know what the hell went on with these. Like, you know, when did he decide to make a new episode? What was the thing that he had to do to make that happen? What, like, because it does seem like a lot of these last two episodes could have been condensed into a single one and it would be stronger. But
yeah, for sure. And they're short. They're very short episodes, right? This is shorter than the last one that everybody said was so short. So,
right. Right. But I just would really love to know what was going on with that, because, you know, that's the thing. Holly does swing for the fences, and it remains to be seen whether that's successful or not. But I just would really love to know the nuts and bolts about, like, when did he make the decision? How much of it was because of the delay and the pandemic and the reshoots and all that stuff? There's got to be a great story there, and I'm looking forward to hearing it. And if we get to do a Fargo wrap-up pod, I'm hoping that we can get some of that word into there. Anyway, we'll be back next week for another all-new episode of Fargo. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.